Perfect. Now I have your number. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Robbie Kramer. You're listening to the Leverage Podcast, where we discuss using your social skills to hack dating, travel, finding your dream job, and becoming a complete man.
Hey guys, welcome back to the show. We've got Luke Tyberski, a former professional football player, also soccer, for those Americans listening, turned triathlete, and voted in the 50 of the world's fittest athletes in 2016. He has a really fascinating story about having to retire from football due to injury and then getting into endurance sports to follow. And then also how that kind of impacted his mental health and the life lessons that came along the way. He also has a podcast and he's a coach with a lot of really cool stuff to share. So welcome to the show, Luke.
Thanks for having me, Robbie. And I love people that do their homework as well. It always gets me excited when people have done a bit of a search on my backstory. So I appreciate that as well.
Sure. A little bit of Google stalking.
Love it.
So tell us your story. You have a really fascinating story. I was so curious to read about it. You've been all over the world playing professional sports. My dream growing up was to become a professional athlete as well. I was a golfer. And played NCAA, almost made it pro, but didn't quite get there. So I understand just the difficulty and the amount of talent at the top. So to get where you were is quite an achievement. So yeah, tell us about your story.
Yeah, so I grew up in Australia, soccer, football is not massive from a professional standpoint there, especially when I was growing up in the 90s. I left Australia in the early 2000s, 2003, I think. So, we're talking way back when, there wasn't really a professional league. It was sort of semi-professional. But my dream as a kid was I want to be a professional soccer player. That was it. Yeah. Like I played every other sport, but you asked me at a four-year-old, as an eight-year-old, as a 12-year-old, that was it. And then I started to show a little bit of talent from 14, 15, 16 and got the wheels turning. And I knew that I would have had to have left Australia to do that. And now Australia is a long way from anywhere in the world. Yeah. And so I knew that...
I've been to Australia, but just even to Bali... It's like, yeah. From Sydney, it's like a 6 or 7 hour flight. And that's like close, right? So,
yeah. So I knew from a young age that I was going to have to leave Australia, leave my parents and very close family, but from a big extended family. Like I had 6 or 7 aunts and uncles who all lived in the same town. My grandmother lived in the same town. We would meet every week for Sunday lunch. Yeah, everyone's birthday would all meet and stuff like that, big parties. So it was a big sort of community of a support network. And I think that's really valuable for later on in my story. And so I left that at 21 to pursue this dream. And I bounced around America, played in the lower leagues there, played over in Belgium. I played over in the UK where I am now. I live in London. So I bounced around in the lower leagues. I was a journeyman, is what some people call it. Mm-hmm. And I always had this undenying self-belief that I could achieve my ultimate dream. And my ultimate dream was just to play professionally as long as I could. Now, we were speaking before we started to record, and I said, I never really made any money out of football, but I didn't have a job until after I retired from football. So I made enough money to support myself. And my parents are very working class. We didn't have a lot of money growing up. Everything that we were bought was because something else was ruined and we couldn't use it anymore. So shoes and clothes, hand-me-down clothes and things like this from next-door neighbors, sporting equipment, whatever. Right. So it wasn't like my parents just went, here's your trust fund, go for your life. It was, we had to watch every penny. So I got...
Was that stressful when it came to your soccer career? Because, I have a lot of friends on the golf circuit, and when you're you know, you got to make the cut to get the paycheck and to feed your family or, you know, feed yourself, that can add a lot of stress and it can have a big impact on your performance.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And there were times where I had to ask mum and dad for help. But the thing was, is they always would offer me before I asked, because they knew from just talking to me on the phone, you know, before things like Zoom and Skype was really early on back then. And so I was always in a really dire strait, and I would borrow money from friends, you know, like, you know, $100 here could do me for like a month of just, you know, basic food to top up what I was making. But then I'd get a contract and then I'd be playing at a club and I'd be like, phew, this is fine. You know, when I could, I would pay people back and all the rest of it. So for me, it was never about making money. So as long as I had enough to put food on the table, cover, you know, shelter, so to speak, and I was healthy, then I never chased money, because my satisfaction was I get up in the morning, I go and kick a ball around for a few hours during the day, and that's my life. So as long as I could do that, and you know, as a 20-year-old, I wasn't really thinking about, oh, I need to start saving, or what's my side hustle, or anything like this. Social media wasn't really happening, you know, at late 90s and early 2000s. So it wasn't like now where it's like you've got to capitalize on your community and market to that and sell this product and build your service up. It was, you know, build your brand up. It was like go to training, work hard, network when you meet people face to face, and then just perform on the field. And yeah, that was it. So that was like a dream come true. Bouncing around the world, you know, I had to find my own communities that I was in, because obviously you have teammates, but like work colleagues, you don't always like all your work colleagues. Same with football. You know, I had two or three friends that played football, but the rest of them was like, I don't want to hang out with these guys because I'm not interested. So I would find friends. I had a bunch of girlfriends around the world when I bounced around, you know, so I had a couple of good relationships. I had a couple of bad ones, you know, for sure. Some of your listeners, I've been there, yeah, both sides of the coin. I am now married, happily married. But you know, when I first left Australia, I was in a long-term relationship, you know, my high school sweetheart, so to speak. And we tried to make it work when I was living in America and she was in Australia. Let's just say that ended badly.
I'm sure. What's the temptation like? And you know, a lot of people would probably guess that as a professional footballer, there's just, you know, girls throwing themselves at you from left to right and center. But I'm curious, what's the actual situation there?
It wasn't so much as being a, you know, professional soccer or football player, because most people in the States don't care. You're not an NFL player. You're not, exactly. You're not a baseball player. You're not a basketball player. But, and I'll be completely candid and honest, having an accent, having an Australian accent, I could have been, you know, winner of a Super Bowl. You know, and I'm sure I would have got the same amount of attention. There was a lot there, and it was tough at times. And then when I was single, let's just say I enjoyed meeting new people because it was easy to do. You know, it was a case of if I went out, I remember I lived in Orlando. I played soccer there for a season, and I'm in a bar with a couple of my friends and chatting to some girl at the bar, you know, having a general conversation early on in the night. So, you know, you're just trying to sort of have a chat. And then in the next hour, there's about probably 10 girls who have just randomly come up and talked to me. And literally the first thing they've said was, are you the Aussie? Because they've heard that there's an Australian in the bar and they want to come over and talk to me because I'm Australian, because I've got an accent. Totally. Say something, I want to hear you talk.
American girls are crazy for Australian guys. It's like... I mean, girls around the world are pretty crazy for Australian guys in general. Something about, I mean, my theory on it, and I spent a lot of time competing against you blokes or whatever when it comes just like, you know, hanging out in Budapest, tons of, there's Australians around the world all the time. Yeah. And Australian guys are typically very masculine, very alpha, very loud, and tend to do really well with the ladies. So, in America, I can't tell you how many times I grew up in, or I went to university down in Pacific Beach, San Diego, which is just a crazy party town. And I can't tell you how many times I would essentially lose girls to Australian guys. So anyway, so it was less about the football and more about the accent, obviously being in good shape and being a cool
guy. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the other thing that my family always installed into me, and it wasn't so much about girls or anything like that, but they always said to me, my parents and my aunts and uncles and my grandmother, they said, especially my grandmother, which is sort of a bit random in this context of the conversation, my grandma giving me dating tips, but she was a pretty cool woman. She said, if you want to engage with someone, then listen. Great, you know,
yeah.
Listen to them and ask questions. And she said something to me once. She said, even when you want to talk, ask another question. And then instead of you speaking, ask another question. And then, I can't remember the context of why she was telling me this, but just something that always reminded me. And says, instead of you adding to the conversation, ask just one more question for the other person to add. And I definitely thought of that a few times when I was having different conversations in bars and you know, different parties and stuff. And it's like, instead of talking about myself, because they just want to hear me speak, I'd ask, the women their questions and they would engage more with me. So it was, yeah, let's just say it was, I connected a few times with a few people.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
That's great advice when it comes to conversation skills. Also sales, they say, you know, the person asking the right questions is typically the one. That's what good salesmen do. They get, you know, people talking and they find out if it's a good fit. So there's so many correlations there. So yeah, your grandma was a smart lady for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And it almost sounds a bit corny, but the thing is, and a lot of these sort of, these phrases and that people use, it's only when you actually start to use them consistently that you realize actually the reason why people say them all the time is because I actually do work, but most people don't actually stick with it. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll ask one question or so, and then, oh, well, I asked the question. I'm going to start talking about myself now, you know. Right. But it's a case of, no, stick with it and just go with it for a while. She was a very smart lady and, I learned a lot. But, you know, I bounced around the States. I was there for about 4 years, and then it was time to tackle Europe, which is a completely different beast in the world of football. And I had some small success in the UK initially, and then short-term deals with, you know, sort of third, fourth division clubs, which doesn't sound very, very big, but it's over in the UK, you've got four levels of full-time professional. And in the fourth division, you make, for an average person working in an office, you make quite good money, I had a little bit of success there, and then I ended up over in Belgium. My agent found me a deal over there, so it was a case of, you know, you get a phone call and said to me, right, can you get to Belgium tomorrow? And I was like, I guess so, it's in Europe. I didn't know geography in Europe back then. I'd only been there for a few months. I'm like, I can get a train, I think, to Brussels. And he's like, yep, do that tomorrow and I'll tell you where you need to go. So I went out there, and once again, I didn't know anyone, and it was a case of building up this community, building up this support network of friends. And in Belgium, I probably spent time with one or two of the players, and the rest of it were just other people who I met, some randomly, some I met through the medical team. I met an osteopath and a personal trainer from the medical team, who became one of my closest friends, and I actually started working with him. So I got a degree in exercise science and always been fascinated with training the body, training the mind as well, because for me they're one and the same, because our thoughts dictate our actions, right? This is sort of going into now sort of my day job these days, is our thoughts dictate our actions. So if we can train our mind to have thoughts that are going to help us be productive, then we're going to be more productive and we're going to take actions that's going to help us get to where we want to go. But if we don't, and just expect our mind to be like this this tame pony, like, you know, like a kid's pony ride, then in reality, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be like a wild stallion where it's just going to run wild. And when you try and tame it, you got no chance. So I've always been fascinated with mental strength work, mindset skills and things like this. And I've been, you know, as an athlete, I've been exposed to a lot of that sort of coaching, and I've been experimenting and using that for myself as an athlete, but also now I share it with other people. So I got to experience different pockets of Belgium as well. So I got to travel, and that just, you meet new people, and obviously language barrier. So I learned how to speak French badly. So, you know, I had this really cool experience where learning a new language, a new culture, a new way of life. You know, like there's a couple of other foreigners or Brits and Americans who played on the team. And in Belgium, you greet another guy by like kissing him on each cheek, you know, like little cheek tap. And for me, I was just like, whatever, like that's their shaking their hand. I'm down for that. But some of the other Brits, they were like, no, I'm not kissing a guy. That's just weird. Right. But it's a case of like, well, this is the culture. This is what you do. So I embraced that. And I found that a lot of the locals were more connected to me, were more willing to talk with me, to invite me into their homes, because I embraced that their culture and also that their form of communication. Whereas I found a French teacher to learn their language, rather than just, I don't care, I'm not speaking French, I'm Australian, I speak English, that's it. So it was adapting to the environment that I was in. And I think that's something that we can all use, is whatever environment we're in, we need to not be a chameleon and hide, but adapt to how it's formed around us.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I see a lot of the time, I live in Kyiv, Ukraine, as I mentioned to you earlier, and I see guys coming into Kyiv, and a lot of the time they'll get labeled as, like, you know, sex tourists or just like kind of like jerks, because the women can tell, like, oh, this guy's just here to, like, you know, kind of being like a bachelor party, doesn't bother to learn the language, or he's lived here for 6 months and he doesn't know a single word in Russian. You know, they don't embrace the culture, and it's really disrespectful, and you miss out on a lot of the amazing connections and experience by not doing that. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. And I lived all over the States, all over America. And I explained to people who haven't spent a lot of time in America or not a lot of time across America, that the way I view it, the way I view the United States is like Europe. You've got pockets that are very similar. So you've got the UK, you've got England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales that are all very similar. Now you've got pockets of the US that are very similar, different cultures, different way of living. Not obviously not different languages, but, and, you know, just different ways of living and different views of the world. Yeah. And then you've got other pockets of, say, over in like the Ukraine and that area of Europe, that, you know, some of the surrounding countries are not the same, but they're similar. Different views on the world and things like that. And, you know, so in the United States, it's very similar to that. So when I went across to the US, it's like how I acted when I lived in Orlando and the way that I like spoke and interacted with people was different to when I lived in Oklahoma. You know what I mean? Like, it's very different. And then when I lived in San Francisco in California, it was different to how I tried to settle in and learn the culture and learn how people interacted with one another and lived in Oklahoma. It was very different to when I went to California and lived in San Francisco. So it's the same country, but it's very different wherever you go. And I found that I was actually welcomed into people's lives, people's homes, invited to parties, you know, connected with not just women, but men as well. And I've got friends still all over the US, all over Europe. And I feel a big part of that is not only because of my Aussie accent, but because I was open to actually, okay, I'm in this new environment. I know what is my normal, what I'm used to being an Aussie, you know, that's quite loves the sound of his own voice, you know, and loves to turn the volume up. But what's everyone else doing around? How can I learn this? How can I, you know, maybe speak a few words and maybe understand the culture and understand why they have this point of view, rather than just challenging the point of view, asking the questions, Right. Why do you think this way? Where does that come from? Who told you this? And not in a derogatory way, but just to learn. Because then all of a sudden, when you understand where someone's conversation is driving from, then you can actually have a what I call an adult conversation where you're not arguing, you're just asking questions and trying to understand where each other is coming from rather than just arguing because you're butting heads. You're coming from opposing views. So when you understand where people's motivation is coming from, and I do this with negative, with criticism as well. You know, I've got documentaries online. I've got a book out. You know, I speak on stage around the world and I get negative reviews. I get negative feedback. I get trolls on social media. And I always, one of the questions I ask myself is, well, where is that coming from? Mm-hmm. You know, is something that I said in my book, is that derogatory in someone else's culture, just as a random example? Or is the word that I used or something that I'm doing in this country where I did this adventure, is that frowned upon? Is that why I'm getting negative reviews? So instead of just fighting back and arguing back, is take a step back and go, well, where are they? What's driving their train of thought, their opinion, and ask them. And it actually, the person who is maybe already on the offensive will take a step back because you're wanting to know why they have that opinion. So you can do that in any situation, scenario, outcome. And that's been a big thing, a helpful thing for me to not only deal with criticism as an athlete, to deal with criticism as a profile online, but also to understand other people's cultures. Great if you're trying to have a conversation with someone who's not from your culture to try and understand their point of view. If you're trying to make a point or just have a general conversation, you can have more of an in-depth conversation if you understand what is driving their opinions.
Right. Yeah. A lot of the time you'll see just people shouting at each other or, metaphorically shouting at each other, through social media or even in a conversation. And neither party is hearing anything the other one's saying. They're just, it's not going in. It's just kind of going like this. And you see that all the time. And I'm sure as an athlete and, professional athlete, you have to be pretty bulletproof. Otherwise that criticism and all that feedback can take you out quite a bit.
And I think one of my biggest advice now is for people on social media or even in the workplace or just anywhere is if someone says something negative about you, and this is something that I learned as a footballer, that I would walk off and the crowd would yell something at you or something like this, because obviously social media wasn't really big when I was playing. It was, does this person know you personally? Mm-hmm. And if they don't know you personally, then why should it affect you personally? Because they don't know who you are. It's a complete stranger in the street saying something about you who they don't know you. So that was
commenting on one thing that they saw. Maybe you made a mistake in a bad pass or whatever, and they're essentially judging your entire life based on that one event.
Exactly. So it's always a case of when I get criticism, and someone told me this years ago, is do they know you personally? And be like, no, they don't know me. So well, why does it bother you? Oh, but they said this. There's just words coming out of another human's mouth. You may never see them again. You may never even hear their voice again. So why allow someone else, what I call a mental real estate? Why, you own your mental real estate, the space between your ears. Why let someone else rent that space for free?
Yeah, good point. I like that analogy.
When you own it.
And it's similar to rejection. A lot of guys take rejection personally and it really stops them from, confidently going after what they want. And it's like, why would you care what that person has to say? Like, they don't know you. Maybe they don't like, the color of your hair, and that's fine.
It's the same thing, rejection and negative criticism. Like, that's what it is. It's rejection is probably just a little bit more blunt and in your face, as a form of negative criticism. But it's a case of, if you're approaching another person and you want to try and have a conversation because you feel some sort of attraction or you feel some sort of connection from your angle and it's not reciprocal and they don't feel that, it's a case of, well, they don't know you. it's potentially their loss. And as we said, these are these words that come out, oh, it just sounds really fluffy. Well, maybe it is. You know the qualities that you have. You know the type of person that you have. But unfortunately, in a bar or in a coffee shop or on a first date or bumping into someone in the street or whatever, you have a second to connect, right? And if you miss that initial connection, then like it's gone. And then after that initial connection, you might have 3 or 4 seconds to seal the deal, so to speak, to then actually have a conversation. Right. So how are you going to show your value as a human, as a person, as a mate, as a, you know, as a partner in 3 or 4 seconds? It's near impossible, right, to show your true value. Yeah. But because they don't know you personally, if you do get that rejection, it's like, well, that's their loss because you know your value.
Right. Did is after all of the, you know, professional football career, you said you were injured at some point and that is what forced you to retire?
I had a lot of injuries, man. I tore loads of things and broke some stuff. When it was at its worst, I had 3 surgeries on 3 different body parts over the space of 11 months.
Wow.
So not even a calendar year, I had sliced open 3 times.
I mean, you hear about footballers getting injured all the time. Was it the case where you just had like a series of injuries at the same time, or were these like aggravated things that kind of built up throughout your career?
So here's a really interesting one for you because of like what your background is and what your podcast is about. Is I was in a long-term relationship that should have been a short-term relationship. So I'm talking like we were together for 5 or 6 years or something. And I wasn't happy. She wasn't happy, but we were just slogging away of trying to make it happen. You know what I mean? It was, right. It was just one of those things.
You get into like a comfortable sort of routine and before you know it, like years pass and both of you are kind of settling. But you know, there's not enough sort of pain or motivation to really change anything a lot of the time. So
100%. So I was in that and my football career started to stumble. Mm-hmm. And I started to get these little injuries. And at start with, it was nothing major. It was like a slightly torn muscle here and something here and something there. But I just kept going and going. And then I would get fit. I'd go to a club. I'd get like a short-term deal, like that offered me a 3-month contract or a month-to-month contract, or it's at one club I got a 1-month contract to cover for someone who was injured. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So there was stuff like this. But so on the physical side, I was breaking. You know, I had all these little niggles. And then on the personal side of things, I was just really unhappy. I was depressed. I didn't know it at the time. In hindsight, looking back, I was battling with depression. Like this is, we're talking about mid to late 2000s. So somewhere from around 2007 to 2010. I was depressed. I was unhappy, but I didn't want to show it to my partner because we were together for several years. We're living together, all the rest of it. So we just bumbled along. And I realized, like, there was this one time where we had an argument at home and I had to go somewhere. And I walked out of the house and I walked up to the bus stop where I would catch the bus into town in London. And I stepped off a bus, literally just stepped off a bus, something I did, you know, probably tens of times, 10 or 20 times every week. And I tore a hamstring stepping off a bus. I'm fit, I'm strong, I'm a professional athlete. I tore a hamstring. Now, I was out for like 4 or 5 weeks, and some of your listeners might be thinking, what the hell is he talking about? Where is he going with this? So there is some science that started to come out over the last maybe like 5 or 10 years that shows, like, basically if you are struggling mentally, then that can basically come out as a physical injury. So from a soft tissue. from a soft tissue standpoint.
I've also studied this before, and I worked with a guy in LA who showed all these different case studies of people who are in an emotionally tough place, and they would either injure themselves or they'd get these kind of freak injuries. He would say they took themselves out in a way because they weren't dealing with whatever they needed to deal with. And that was one way that they had to face it. So,
yeah, exactly. So like I 100% do not blame her. Obviously we're not together anymore. 100% don't blame her, but it was because the relationship we're in, it was both our faults, you know, neither of us took that responsibility to actually make a change. So yeah, I was having all these soft tissue injuries, these torn calf muscles, a torn hamstring and this and that. And at the time I was like, I don't understand. And then it came to a big T. I had all these surgeries that went through this whole period where I was really low. And then it got to a point where all of my friends and family and girlfriend at the time were like, Luke, your body's telling you something. You know, you've been battling now for like 2 years with injuries, 2.5 years with injuries nonstop. Maybe you should retire. And I'm like, I'm 27. I'm going to be retired a hell of a long time. Yeah. And like, okay, I had no real money in the bank. So it wasn't like, you know, I don't care, I'm secure. But it was like, I'm going to be retired for a long time. So what if I'm willing to do the rehab, to do the training, do the preparation, to go and trial at different clubs? If I'm willing to do that and make that choice, it's not a sacrifice, it's a choice. I don't really like to use the word sacrifice, because if you're sacrificing something, then why are you not doing the thing you're sacrificing? That's what you really want to do. So it's a choice. It's a choice that we make. Then why not go and do it? So I did. I pushed on for another year, kept having all these little niggling injuries. And then finally I retired. And for a moment, it was like this weight off my shoulders, because I was like, oh, now I don't have to keep trying to do this. I'm not going to keep breaking down. But then instantly I had this loss of identity. Who am I? I'm not a footballer anymore. Well, what am I? Like, I've had an exercise science degree. I was coaching other athletes. I was working both physically and mentally with other athletes while battling with depression, hiding that to myself from my girlfriend and everyone. So while we were still doing bits and pieces on the side, but I was always acknowledged that I was a footballer. That was it. So now I retired. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I basically ran away from life. And we mentioned before we recorded that a lot of people who retire younger than what they would have liked, I was 28 years of age, and who were battling a little bit mentally, they find like a vice to sort of blow off some steam. You know, they get addicted to drugs and alcohol or sex or gambling or anything like that. Well, I threw myself into the den of endurance sports, and I got addicted to doing endurance sports. So what I mean by endurance sports is not marathons. I'm talking about double marathons, you know, ultra marathons, double Ironman triathlons that took me 35 hours, running 6 marathons in 7 days through the middle of the Sahara Desert. That's where I started. So
I mean, you're already in top shape being a footballer. So I guess, you know,
yeah,
for someone of that caliber, you know, you could. Yeah, I was reading on your website, you went from Morocco to somewhere across the desert there, the Sahara Desert?
Yeah, I did a race through the Sahara Desert in Morocco, where you run 6 marathons in 7 days through the middle of Sahara Desert, carrying all your food for the entire week. So think about this.
They don't give you a camel, huh?
No camel in the backpack, man. So, like, to give your listeners a bit of an idea, is what you eat for breakfast on Monday morning and what you have for dinner on Sunday night, and everything you eat in between, you have to carry in a backpack. Like, just for the average person who, you know, eats normally, whatever that means, but like eats, you know, a normal amount of calories every day, that's a hell of a lot of food. Plus, you're running.
Keep it from going bad, so it's got to be like canned, or it's probably heavier, right?
Well, it's dehydrated stuff, so it's all in like packets and whatever. But then The other thing is you're still running six marathons in 7 days over that time. So you're burning more calories. So it's like it's a mixture of, do I carry more food, but then it weighs more? Do I carry less? And maybe I go to bed hungry, you know? Right. So I carried less and I lost, I don't know how many pounds I lost, but there's photos of me at the end of the race and I lost a significant amount of weight.
Yeah, I mean, the caloric deficit every day, you know, if you're running a marathon, and I mean, how many calories do you need to eat to sustain to be at like zero?
It's got to be. Yeah, I took an average of 2,200 calories a day, like in my backpack. That was it. To be zero, I've done metabolic testing in the past. My sort of zero calorie to be level at like years ago was about 2,700 calories. So if I'm eating 2,200 calories a day, I'm in a 500, let's say, calorie deficit before I start running.
Right. What does a marathon burn? That's got to be, I mean, just I would guess like 7,000 or something crazy like that.
It's not quite that much, but it's definitely a few thousand. So, you know, and then it's a cumulative over time and it's hot, so you burn more calories because your body's trying to cool yourself down. So, yeah.
It was, water as well?
You got rationed water. So, yeah, like you could have more, but you get a time penalty. But you got rationed water every day. So you got, you know, like 3 liters in the morning, and then at one or two checkpoints, you got a liter and a half. And at the end, you got 3 liters. And then that was it. And then if you wanted more, you got a time penalty. So.
I spent 7 days in the desert in Burning Man, and you have to bring your own food and water. But I had in a 30-foot RV to keep all that stuff, and I didn't have to carry it, thank God. So I can't imagine. So anyway, you're getting into these endurance sports, and you're addicted to it at this point, you said, right?
Yeah, because I went from running through the desert. I went out to Nepal and ran down Mount Everest in the world's highest ultra marathon, running down from base camp. Spent like 5 weeks high up in the rural mountains with a few Nepalese ultra runners, you know, living in huts that had no electricity, no running water, no one really spoke the language, sleeping next to buffaloes, you know, all these type of crazy thing. No toilets, no sanitary, you know, nothing. So I went full like off the reservation, so to speak, and come back, and then doing 100-mile running races, double Ironman triathlons, you know, that took me 35 hours nonstop, no sleep. So I'm just like, everyone needs to be bigger, harder, you know, longer than the last one. And I had this crazy idea that what if I could make a living out of this? What if I could make this my career, where I do these crazy big challenges all around the world? I speak about them on stages, share my journey, my adventures, write books about them, have documentaries made about them, and stuff like this, train other athletes as well. So this was sort of like my pipe dream post-football. Mm-hmm. And everyone just laughed at me. It was like, Luke, when are you going to grow up and get a real job? And I'm like, I've never had one, so I'm going to try and figure it out for myself.
Yeah, totally. I feel you, man. I had one real job for 2 years working at a bank, and it was the most miserable experience of my life because, you know, I went from golfing every day to working in an office, and that was hell on earth. And then I figured out how to be a dating coach after that, which everyone told me I was crazy. So, but, you know, now I think a lot of people would be like, well, yeah, that's a total awesome, normal career. You know, you're a blogger, an author, a speaker, blah, blah, blah. But back then, yeah, they probably thought, everyone thought you were crazy, right? For one.
Yeah, like 2011 was when I told everyone, this is what I'm doing. Yes, internet was around. Yes, social media was around, but it wasn't like it has been over. No, not at all. You know, like Facebook was for kids that went to university,
right?
You know, like, It's gone full circle now, but you know, Twitter was just, it was around, Instagram wasn't around, but yeah, so it was, yeah, everyone just sort of went like, how are you going to do this? And I was like, I don't know, I'm going to figure it out. And any money I made went into my next adventure, and then I started pitching myself to magazines to write articles. So my trip to Nepal basically cost me nothing because I wrote several features. I pitched the idea to magazines and said, look, I'm going out to live in these rural areas. So a running magazine, an outdoor magazine, a travel magazine, I pitched these ideas to and pretty much, you know, wrote a very similar piece aimed at their audience, but the general story was very similar. And that covered the cost of my trip. I didn't make any money, but I was out of the UK
for my lifestyle and having fun doing what you like to do.
I think I was,
addiction, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's it. It was just like, you know, it was like free crack. So I was like, woohoo, I'm in. But then it was a case of like, okay, after that, now I've got connections at magazines. And then now I've done something very few people know or people have ever done. So then people want to hire me at festivals, like adventure festivals, running festivals, for me to come and talk. And I was like, hey, I've been doing this for like 2 or 3 years now. Hey, can you give me like £500? You know, and in the speaking circuit, that's nothing. You know, and but at the time when I'd been doing it for free for years, I was just like, well, I'm just going to ask. And then people was like, yeah, okay, yeah, we can pay you that. And then I started to talk to other speakers and started to do some speaking courses and like Toastmasters, and I got a speaking coach and just sort of inquired, like, you know, what are people charging? And they're like talking about thousands of pounds, and I was like, I'm charging hundreds. Like, I need to step my game up. Yeah. So then it was like, okay, maybe I just throw it out there. And people started to pay me a little bit more. So I started to make a little bit more money and make it sustainable. And then I could pay for other adventures and other challenges and things like this. So that was sort of how I was paying for everything. Because on the outside, there was a space of like 6-7 years where you would think I was living the most awesome life. Bouncing around the world, like, you know, China a couple of times, Nepal, New Zealand. I went out to Australia and like to do adventures all over Europe, Africa. I did a big triathlon, 2,000 kilometers in 12 days from Morocco to Monaco, where I swam the Gibraltar Strait between Spain and Africa, cycled the entire southeast coast of Spain, and then ran from the Spanish-French border to Monaco all in 12 days. Had a documentary made about it.
I've done that drive. Beautiful drive. Yeah. I don't know about running it.
Yeah, it's insane. So, you know, but I started to create this network of people. I started to have contacts at magazines, brands were interested in supporting me. Still not making any money. It was almost like a card, like very similar to my football career, where I'm actually surviving doing this awesome sort of job, so to speak. And I'm not really making any money, but for now I'm like, yeah, this is cool because I'm actually networking and I'm actually, you know, speaking on stage, you know, every month at least. And I'm starting to make a little bit from that, but that's going out to other challenges and stuff. And I'm building my profile, I'm building my talent, you know, I'm getting better at what I do. So I was like, actually, yeah, I'm going to do this for a few more years and then figure out how I can actually start making, you know, some sort of real income and not just live month to month, so to speak. And I did my big challenge, the ultimate triathlon from Morocco to Monaco. And in the middle of all of this, we were talking about earlier, my girlfriend at the time, we had this big conversation where she's like, I want to move back to Australia because she was Australian. She was a bit older than me. I want to start a family. I want to live near my family. I was like, cool, great. I've got this big challenge. I'm going to Nepal. I'm going to go there for like 8 weeks. I'll come back to London, sort up our flat, and then I'll move back. Anyway, long story short, I went to Nepal, she went to Australia, I came back and basically never heard from her again. And
I would guess you would have wanted to do the next, after.
I know, like, it's, I gave you like the fully snippet version. It was basically, I don't want to be with you anymore. I wish you well in an email. That was it. That was after 6 years. That was the reason I got for why we broke up, pretty much. Anyway, so there's a whole other story to that. I allude to it in my book Chasing Extreme, because it's a constant throughout a period of my life, because that's one of the things that really, I don't want to say tipped me over the edge, but made life really tough with my mental health as well, because of my own relationship breakdown. So, as I said, on the outside, it looks like my life was awesome, bouncing around the world, but I had a long-term relationship breakdown. My mental health was going south. I was battling with insomnia, sleeping 6 to 8 hours a week at times. Wow. A week. Some nights I wouldn't even go to bed. I would run
from all the adrenaline from the activity, or just
life, man. Just my mind would never stop because I'm thinking about how crappy I felt. I'm listening to like sad songs because of my breakup one night. I'm angry another night. So I was like, right, I'm going to go and punish myself. It's 11 o'clock at night. I'm going to go and run to the central of London and back, you know, and then I end up running, you know, a midnight marathon, you know, run for like 4 hours from midnight till 4 a.m, come home, have a shower, you know, do whatever, have some breakfast. And then all of a sudden the sun's starting to come up. It's like, I'm going to start my day. I didn't even go to bed, you know. Wow. So there's so many emotions that I wasn't dealing with. The breakup.
If you have an extreme lifestyle, you're going to have very extreme emotions, you know?
And the highs were like super high and the lows were crippling low.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been there, and when you have those high highs, it's like to get back there, you got to keep doing the crazy shit. But, you know, it's just like a seesaw or a scale. Like when you're up here, you can also be way down here as well. And it can be a really, really unsustainable lifestyle, no matter what, you know, you can choose. Like for me, it was partying and sex and you know, putting on these trips with Playboy models and going on yachts. And, you know, people would be like, wow, you know, and eventually I was like, this is horrible.
Yeah, from the outside, it sounds amazing. But on the inside, for the individual that you are, you're, you know, as perspective, it right. changes from everyone.
Yeah, and when you're not on the trip, then imagine how you feel then. It was crazy. So when most of the time you were doing this, were you in that long-term relationship or were you single at all?
For about half of the time where this like 6-year period that I was doing these big challenges, I was for about three of the years I was with my ex-partner, and we were together while I was still playing football as well. And then I continue on to do these big challenges. And then in 2015 was my big 2000 kilometer in 12 days swim, cycle and run from Morocco to Monaco, the ultimate triathlon. And I thought this was going to be the big thing that was going to put me on the map. Right, this is something that I've been working towards for about 5 years, 4 or 5 years, and no one had ever done it before. I convinced a guy to come out and film it for free.
This wasn't like a something you can join and compete. No, just you. Okay.
People swim the Gibraltar Strait every year. There's an organization that runs swims. So there's probably a couple of dozen people that swim it every year. People have cycled the southeast coast of Spain, and I don't know if anyone's ran across the complete south of France, but yeah, people cycle it all the time. You know, a bunch of cyclists live out there and whatever, but no one had ever done that route. I hadn't really found anyone that had done that distance of triathlon, especially not in that period of time. Or even at all, really, because it's a really odd distance, because you've got a super long swim, super long run, super long bike, and a super long run. Whereas most triathlons, like even Ironman, they have a thing called a Deca Ironman, but you do an Ironman one day, you do an Ironman another day, and for like 10 days, but it's still only an Ironman on one day. So it's a very different format. I thought this was it. This was going to put me on the map. This was going to elevate me to some sort of status that my phone was going to be ringing off the hook for speaking gigs, for sponsors, for this, for that. And I went out and I did it, and I had an award-winning documentary made. You know, it's awesome. The filmmaker did a phenomenal job. And no one cared, man, if I'm honest. no one cared, like from what I was expecting, you know what I mean? I was left with, like, loans to pay back because my phone didn't really ring. I was left with physical injuries, mental injuries, because the high was so high, and then the low was just horrendous. You know, like I then was struggling to live, just to support myself, because afterwards like no one was booking me. I was getting less work.
You were hoping to get speaking engagements and, you know, paid sort of opportunities from it, and it just didn't result in that?
Yeah. As I said, like, to be really blunt and to be really short, no one cared. And then to rub salt into the wound, so this is where now my story changes. My body basically shut down. I was forced to stop doing all this physical activity because of different physical ailments. So I was having headaches for 6 or 7 hours every morning when I woke up. I was sleeping for like 14, 15 hours every day. And then I said wake up, headache for like 6 hours, and then it'd go away, and then it'd get to like 7, 8 o'clock at night, and I'd be exhausted and go to bed. I had no energy whatsoever. I was completely exhausted. I went to see a sports doctor who worked with a lot of professional triathletes. She was an ex-professional triathlete, and just said, look, I've done this. This is how I've been training. This is what's going on. I just feel exhausted. I went to see a neurologist about my brain, and I had some medication, short-term medication for that. She did all these tests and found out that some of my hormone levels were out of whack. One of my hormones wasn't really secreting, my DHEA, my human growth hormone, which is a precursor to testosterone, very vital in men, obviously. So that was basically zero. And my cortisol was through the roof. Other ones were really high. Other hormones were really low. And basically the previous 6 years of doing all these extreme sports, chasing that next high, you know what I mean, addicted to them, mm-hmm. I called it my overdose. And it was time to stop and go into my own, I'm using air quotes here, my own personal rehab, which was just really focusing on taking care of my physical health, which then knocked on to start taking care of my mental health and understanding and asking myself, and this sounds super deep, but who am I? What am I doing in life? And how do I want to live my life? And I spent 18 months of soul searching, I guess, to a degree, alongside no real physical activity, to get to a point where it's like, right, now I know where, how, and why I want to move forward in the direction that I'm going.
So two questions. How did you manage to support yourself during that time? And what did that, like 18 months, where were you? What did that look like? You know, and how are you sustaining yourself?
It's a great question, because you hear people who do this stuff like me, you know, whether it's starting a business or an entrepreneur, and they go, yeah, I do this and do this, and then it crashed and burned, and I had like 18 months where I did nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think the same questions. I was like, well, you've got to pay rent, pay your mortgage, you know, feed yourself. Oh, how do you survive? Right. And the long and short answer was I went into debt. Like, that was it, because I did some work. So I was doing some virtual coaching that I could do, and I did a couple of virtual talks. So this was like back in 2016, before, you know, like the pandemic, when it was like normal. So I would do some, but any sponsorship stuff that I had was gone. I had no content to write for magazines, so that was gone. So my credit card got extended. I got a personal loan. I consolidated a few other loans, plus I bumped that up. So I was like, okay, now I've got that. But cross between the bank supporting me and a little bit of income from online coaching and things like this to supplement that, that's how I survived for the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. And like, it's not sexy. It's not cool. And a lot of people don't like to admit that because they're a bit ashamed. But you know what? Like, part of that process, those 18 months, was being vulnerable with my truth. And my truth is I went into, you know, 5 figures of debt to simply survive after that, because I went all in on the ultimate triathlon to make it happen. Didn't quite have the funding for it, but I went all in, you know, to support it myself. And it was like a business investment. It didn't pay off. So that's how I supported myself through that period. And that 18 months, what did it look like? I was in London, you know, where I am now. For about the first 6 months, it was a lot of sleep. As I talked about, I went from 14 hours to 12 hours to 10 hours of sleep. My outgoings didn't really change because I wasn't doing anything. I didn't really see anyone unless people came around to the house. To go back to this point here is about 4 months, 5 months before I went out and did the Ultimate Triathlon, I was at this trade show looking for sponsorship, and I went to a company, to this brand, and it's like a brand that I've used, and I wanted to get them to be a sponsor. And there was this woman there, and I knew who I had to talk to. It was a guy, his name was Mike. So I asked her, and I said, excuse me, is Mike around? And she's like, no, he's not here, but I'm in charge. You can talk to me. And it was this Aussie woman. And like, I tried to stay away from Australians for numerous reasons, right? My ex was Australian. I was like, I don't want to deal with that anymore. I'm Australian. If I want to hang out with Aussies, I'll go back to Australia. So, you know, I was not in any, you know, sort of like, I had no radar of Australians. Anyway, so she was Australian. We got talking. I gave her 5 minutes because she was an Aussie. Anyway, so we exchanged numbers for some reason, because I think she said, we should catch up for a coffee. And I was like, yeah, sure. So I gave her one of my business cards and wasn't really expecting. I wasn't dating this time. I didn't go on any dates for like 3 years, wow, 3.5 years after my breakup. Not in a date. Like, I was
really
not interested at all. Yeah, 100%. 100%. Wasn't even like no one night stands, no nothing. I was not interested in anyone.
Sex drive, huh?
No, 100%, because I was too busy doing all this extreme endurance stuff. Mm-hmm. So the reason I'm telling this story was, so then this woman, her name is Vanda, she messaged me the next day. Like, I left her at 5 o'clock on a Sunday. At like 9 o'clock Monday morning, she texts me and she's like, how about a coffee sometime? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what? This girl knows what she wants. And I was like, that's cool.
Yeah.
So we went on a date a month or so later, because I was busy running around doing stuff, training. I went to Malta for a camp and for a promotional thing, whatever. So we didn't see each other for a month or so. Then we went on a couple of dates, and you know, I started to get this feeling of actually like this woman, and I like spending time with her. The first time I've had this sort of feeling in nearly 4 years. So anyway, so the reason why I tell you that is because for like 4 or 5 months we were sort of talking, and then I did the Ultimate Triathlon, and she's an osteopath. So I asked her, would you like to come out to the Ultimate Triathlon as my medical team? Mm-hmm. Thinking at the end of this, I'm either going to be single, because she's going to be like, this guy's crazy, I don't want any part of this, right, or I've got a keeper. Right. And like, if you watch the documentary, The Ultimate Triathlon, Vanda, she's on it. She did an amazing job with the rest of my tiny crew. She patched me up. She put me back together every day. And we stayed together after The Ultimate Triathlon. And then those 18 months after, she was a massive support. She was just there to listen when I was ready to talk. I shed tears to her. I opened up about the extent of my mental health. I was completely vulnerable with her. She made me feel safe. And so what those 18 months looked like was, one, I had a very supportive person by my side who I felt super comfortable with. And two, she knew that we weren't living together, but you know, she knew when I needed time to myself, and she knew when to figure stuff out, but also when I needed help and needed support, she was there for me as well. So she definitely played a massive part to get me through those 18 months. And then after that, I realized I've got a keeper. So we got married.
Yeah, totally. Sounds like a keeper for sure.
Yeah. So I hope that in a long-winded way answered those two questions.
Yeah, for sure. Because can imagine, you know, you get lonely, you get when you're not really working and you're not really working out, you know, you kind of have your health, your wealth, and your relationships, and those three pillars, also your mental health as well. But when you know, when one starts to go out, it'll affect the others. And then pretty soon you can end up in a place where everything's like at a unworkable level. So
100%. And, you know, like my mental health was pretty tough at times, you know, as I said, like I battled with binge eating for years and I didn't, that's the only piece of that mental health puzzle that I was battling with that I didn't speak about with anyone, not even my wife, Vanda, at the time. The first time I talked about that was when I published my book, because I thought if I'm going to write this, and I wrote it myself, I didn't have a ghostwriter. And it's an autobiography of basically, you know, the long version of what we've been talking about today. If I'm going to write this, I want to be 100% open. I don't want to be 90%. I don't want to be 95%. I don't want to be 98%. I want to be 100%. So I was like, you know what? If I'm 100%, I've got to talk about the last like 3 years where I've been binge eating, you know, buying crap, eating it, vomiting it up, you know, purging it up, that type of stuff, eating like loads of food and then not eating for 2 days. So my weight stayed the same, you know, all this sort of stuff. You know, I said I stood on tops of bridges twice, not wanting to live. And I taught myself off standing on tops of bridges. I had the insomnia and the depression. You know, some days I could not leave the house. So my mental health was so low. Then my physical health plummeted, where I had no energy to work out. I had no energy to run. I didn't want to run. My wealth was, you know, pretty dark because I was in this massive amount of debt. So it was a case of, right, this is it. This is what I've got in front of me. I can either sit here, and this is over a period of like months, right, that I'm having these conversations. I can either sit here and do nothing and nothing is going to get better, or I can try and get 1% better every day. And the days that I don't get 1% better, just try not to get any worse. Mm-hmm. So maybe over a week I only get 4% better. And I look at that at the end of the week, wow, like I got 4% better this week. Yeah. You know, and then that's how I approached life. I thought, well, how am I going to be more stronger mentally, you know, with my mental health? And I'm speaking to my wife, or my girlfriend at the time, now wife, opening up to her, and she was encouraging me to go to therapy. So I was like, right, I'm going to go to therapy. And that helped me get a little bit better every day, a little bit better every week. I got tools from therapy to help me every day. I went to see a sports doctor for my health. I saw a neurologist for my headaches. So all of these bits and pieces over a day, over a week, over a month, over 18 months. And then also, as I said, like doing a bit of soul searching, okay, like I'm not an athlete anymore. I'm not a footballer. I've been battling with my mental health. Let's take care of that. Now, how do I want to live the rest of my life? Because I don't want to be constantly in this merry-go-round of, oh, I get a little bit of money here. I spend that on an adventure and now I've got none.
Right.
So then I had to really understand from a business perspective is like, how is this going to work? How am I going to do that? And then take care of my mental health, my physical health, and, you know, try and work through that. So that was that whole 18-month period to get from the end of the ultimate triathlon, where it was this the biggest and craziest challenge I've ever done. I thought this was going to be it. You know, I had 7 screenings around the world of documentary. It's like, this is awesome. But in reality, it got me no traction from a business perspective. So I spent the next 18 months figuring all that out with my health as well.
And after the 18 months, did you find yourself more in like a balanced place? Like what changed with your lifestyle and are you in a similar sort of stage now, or how did that transition?
Yeah, like I've evolved as a person for sure. Out of those 18 months. So that, to give people a timeline, we're talking about sort of like start of 2018, end of 2017 is when things started to turn. And yeah, like I took that time, those 18 months also, to really understand the life lessons that I've learned on my journey. You know, some of the adventures we've talked about, and you know, earlier on we talked about all the different cultures and communities that I've been exposed to all around the world, I've learned so much. So it was almost like, okay, I've learned how to use Google, right? I can use Google now because it's like my own personal Google experience. I type in, you know, what do I do for this? And I type it into my personal Google. It's like, well, there was this one time and this other time where this happened. Why don't you try that? So then I was able to see the world of full more opportunities. And I was able to see the world in a more positive light. I had so much more gratitude for what I had rather than trying to look towards what I wanted. Like I always planned and prepared for the future. I learned from the past, but I had gratitude for having the ability to live in the present moment. So I started to try and spend more time in the present moment where my feet were, so to speak, and start living there. Plan for the future, learn from the past, but live in the present moment. And that with being more, having more gratitude and actually understanding how I'm able to, how I was able to get to where I was, stay alive, stay afloat, you know, have a loving girlfriend, do all this stuff, and really use the life lessons that life had taught me, that was how I moved forward over from those 18 months onwards. And since then, the end of 2017 to now, I've personally continued my personal development, personal growth. It's gone on an upward trajectory. Yes, you know, it's never dead straight, but I'm continuing to grow. I now work with individuals, work with professional sporting teams. I work with corporations, execs, entrepreneurs, and help them overcome obstacles, adapt to setbacks, and see opportunities in their own life. From a coaching perspective, from a workshop perspective, from a keynote speaking perspective as well. So my trajectory of life has continued to rise through that, and I've really been able to now narrow in not only just what I'm good at, what I'm talented at, but what others have found of value that I've offered. So like the workshops that I do, my 3-hour workshops, my one-to-one coaching sessions and things like that, that is now what is helping me move forward into the future from a personal development, from a professional perspective, and also from a financial one as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you have so many experiences from and all the learnings from all that crazy stuff. So sharing that information, you know, for anyone who's trying to do whatever they're doing, and I'm sure they're not doing it as insane as you kind of did. So that's awesome, man. So how do people find you, and how can people get a hold of you and find your work?
Yeah, so my central hub is luketoberski.com, and I'm sure that you'll have that in the show notes. You can see my name. It's just simply my name. And you can Google that. I'll come up on the front page. I'm on social media, Instagram, Luke Toberski, Twitter, Luke Toberski, Luke Toberski, the athlete on Facebook, if you're on Facebook. And you can see my documentaries on Amazon, The Ultimate Triathlon and The 500 Man, and my book, Chasing Extreme, which is, as I said, like it's, I don't have a closet. You know, people say I've got skeletons in the closet. I don't even have a closet anymore. I literally opened it up and went 100% all in. This is life. You know, I didn't hold back. If you do listen to books, I 100% recommend getting the audio version, because there's bonus material in the audio version. So at the end of each chapter, I dig a little bit deeper, share more stories, go into a little bit more detail into a few of the things that I talk about in each chapter. But the paperback is still pretty cool as well. So you can find that on Amazon, on my website, or on Audible if you like to listen to stuff. And yeah, if you've got any questions, just get in touch. I'm easy to find. I answer all my own stuff, and be cool to hear from your audience and what they learned from today's podcast.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it. You've been such an authentic and open guest. It's rare to find people who so like genuinely share their story, all the, you know, the lows and the crazy up and downs. So thanks for, sharing all that with us. And it's been great chatting.
I appreciate it, mate. Thanks for having me on. And have a great day yourself.
Thanks for listening. If you want more, go to innerconfidence.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast for the latest episodes.